my great pleasure tonight to welcome Alan Gurganis to the Fine Arts Work Center. Alan's written many incredible books, including most recently Local Souls, a collection of novellas. And I came to Alan's work before I met him. You know, I read his work, and he writes these incredible sentences that are funny and sophisticated and heartbreaking, and I think rightfully so. He's been called the heir to Faulkner and Welty. But also, he completely inhabits these characters, like an ancient Confederate widow or a greatest generation father coming to terms with, or trying to come to terms with his gay son. So I went to grad school, and they had the teachers there in the beginning of every semester. They would kind of like trot out the teachers. It was like a beauty pageant. So you'd go in the room and you got to write down one, two, or three. And they said, well, you know, write down your favorites. And if you get number three this time, next time you'll get number one. So I went in there dutifully and I did my list, you know, very middle class. And I spelled everything properly and I got number three. And I thought, well, that's fate, you know. So I went in the next semester. And I got number three again. And then the third semester, I got number three. And then I realized that the game was rigged. And then I learned later you could go in and, like, bitch and yell. And, like, they'd give you, you know, number one. So then I heard Alan was coming. So I walked in and they had the, you know, everyone was in the big room. And I thought, okay, I'm going to put Alan at number three, you know, so I get him. But then it was like the hand of fate, you know, or like middle class raising, said, no, put him as number one. And lo and behold, I ended up there. So I felt like, you know, I'd earned it. But I was worried because I'd learned that not all great writers are great teachers. It didn't take me long to lose that. But I found that... you know, as a former student, I can say that Alan is both. He's a deeply generous man with a complete moral vision. He's a very gifted teacher. You know, he learned from Grace Paley and John Cheever, Stanley Elkin, John Irving, and he's passed down his own knowledge to writers like Ann Patchett, Elizabeth McCracken, and Donald Antrim. And I know all his former students adore him. It speaks to his generosity. He was so eager and willing to help other writers get better. You know, many writers you meet are kind of doom and gloom, but talking with Alan, after I speak with him, I always want to go write and do some work. You know, he knows that writing is a holy calling, and I think he's our best evangelist for the art form. And I'm very pleased to welcome him here because I think his vision of creativity falls in line with what the Work Center is all about. Just keep moving forward. Ignore the false prophets, and above all, just sit down at your desk or go into the studio and get something done. Just do some work. We're so lucky to have him here today. So please join me in welcoming Alan Gurganis.
Hi there. Thanks so much. Good evening, brothers and sisters. I have an evangelical streak. I have a secular mind and an evangelical heart, brothers and sisters, and I'm moved to textify. T-E-X-T, textify. I'll even begin with scripture, even though I'm not a conventional believer. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Yes. How easy it is to forget that, brothers and sisters. Language is so debased in this culture, and we're the practitioners, we're the votives, we're the ones who are keeping it alive and available and spiritually pumped up and ready to do what it has been doing all these years. The powers that be have forgotten language, but we haven't, have we? We care about reading and writing. We're reading and writing ourselves alive. And it's such a joy to be with a community of people who are fellow believers, brothers and sisters. I'm thrilled to be with my student, Matt Null, whose work riveted me. He was number one on my list all the years I was at Iowa. I knew immediately when I read three sentences that this was the real McCoy. And he was trying to do for West Virginia what I've been trying to do for North Carolina. So there's some deep understanding there. It's so great to be back here. I've been very happy in this town. I love this town. It's one of my homes. I'm very appreciative of Rob Phelps' piece in the local paper. It was so specific and so generous, and he went to so much trouble, and I really appreciated that. It made me feel welcome when my hotel room had a copy of the article waiting for me, along with my friend Helen Miranda Wilson had left me tangerines and soup and pistachios and coffee. And I have the great good luck to own one of her paintings, and it's the only work of art that's visible from my desk. I can reach out. It's three feet away from me and touch it. I don't touch it, but it touches me. And so I feel like this is a homecoming, and I'm so happy to be back. I appreciate the work you're doing. I know that this must be a strange time of year, and you're 7 and 8 months here for the fellows. We are all subject to cabin fever. There's that excitement of the first couple of months of that energy and that at last I'm going to take myself seriously. And then you have the horrible opportunity to take yourself seriously. I know what it feels like, brothers and sisters. I get so weary, my bones get so weary. Sometimes you think there's no way to improve on a blank page, and it takes so much courage to try to put anything down, any line, any shape. And I want to preach to the choir, because the choir, your singers, we need your voice, we need your songs. They need us whether they know it or not. And we have to help and encourage each other. Those friends that you've made here are the friends you have for life, and you can take them with you. To have two or three readers in the world who'll drop everything and read what you've written is the greatest gift imaginable. And I've been very lucky in my friends, and in my students, and in my compeers. It's hard to decide what to read. I brought a 19th century passage, and then I brought a passage that is contemporary, but is based on very big weather. And I thought that might be more appropriate. So I'd like to read a passage from Local Souls from a novella called Decoy. And then I look forward to having a freer exchange in questions and answers. But thank you for having me. Decoy. We liked living on the river. Built the dock and everything for our kids, and then the grandkids came and they loved it. The water is just a trickle and lacks a proper straightaway to sail real far, real fast. But our youngsters got good enough with their sailfishes so they could handle ocean-going rentals down at Wrightsville Beach. All grade A swimmers. Oh, we made sure of that. Deck overhung the River Lithium, a muddy, inching stream that, like the man tells in the song, didn't say nothing. It just kept rolling along. And that was fine with us. You know, like background, the noise meant to help uneasy sleepers like me to finally doze off. First came a hurricane named Gretel. Never even gusted past 50. Well, it ain't a hurricane if it drops to 74. And since the letter H follows G, neighbors joked how we should fear Gretel's brother Hansel coming to hurt us next for two. As usual, we felt we got off easy, us white folks in Riverside, Fall's most desirable 12 blocks. We all went to bed after one more than our standard several bourbons, and we slept sound, having ducked another biggie. But half dreaming as we did, half drunk as we were, we would wake to trouble, friends. My yes, trouble right here in River City. First, Jan and I recognized something was off. We heard our birds, Billy and Jill, just going berserk downstairs. That would have been about 3 a.m. The cockatiels Jan had foolishly bought, then named for our absent kids to offset certain empty nest feelings. They were just squawking like the devil. Janet sits up saying, "What's got into them? Storm was a fizzle. I'll just go check, Bill. Remember how that one mouse spooked him out so last year?" Pitch black dark, and Jan climbs off the edge of our four-poster, opens the door into the hall. She wanders to our staircase, and she's halfway down before I hear her turning back my way. Janet's usual calm governs every word. "Billy? Billy? Billy, our birds might just be drowning." Well, that got me up. You accept is how things will change, but never overnight. You expect the mercy of a little slowness, you know. I put on bedroom slippers and a silk robe as if it were Christmas morning, and I'm just going down to photograph the kids opening their Santa loot. But tonight, to wander downstairs and to be suddenly waiting to slush arms lifted into your dark dining room, to ford your dining room. Then you hit something smelling like a badly kept kennel and stranger's motor oil making one wrong mix, and all arrived here silent since you went to sleep among your fellow citizens. That the water in your house feels river cold seems logical enough. Far creepier, these stripes of warm, God knows what's fermenting in this chemical slop, seems a hell rehearsal with water being fire. Its lithium content does not cut our shock tonight. You descend into a house, become aquarium. It offers furthest practice that you're getting good at saying goodbye. Bye-bye, property. So long, responsibility. And finally, maybe adios to solid earth and matter itself. Dust to dust is at least tidier than dust to mud. Heroic, I waded into our kitchen and idiotic turned on each non-working light switch. Lucky for us, there was most of a moon and it made everything go silver, mercury. Caged birds still kept sounding crazy, and then I saw it. Something swimming near them, circling our kitchen's marble-topped island. I blindly found a broom and prodded toward what seemed a black beaver otter paddling hard. One hissing yowl proved this must be the Blanchard Siamese cat. How the hell it had washed into our home, I could not guess. I saw why Jan's birds were freaking out, but eating something feathered seemed the last thing this cat might be craving right now. Jan, honey, we've got the Blanchard's Tang or Chang in here swimming laps. Ming, she corrected. And then we had the comedy of my trying to save a drowning pet so irritated it would kill you for getting it above the waterline. Finally, I found Jan's thickest oven mitts and put them on, and holding this thrashing, oil-blackened creature as far from me as I could, head outermost, I heaved it on top of the fridge. It did not sound real grateful there. No, we counted ourselves among the lucky ones, really. Because of a river hillside, our home stands three stories, not Riverside's usual two. We sat on our roof beside our cage cockatiels, wet and noisy. We had settled between two dresser drawers stacked with family photos, stock coupons, Janet's laptop, couldn't find its case. It contained the all-important will. Brilliant, I was about to leave all my life and death heart medications lined up neat along our bedside table. If our dear neighbor hadn't motored past right then in his aluminum bass boat, I think we might still be perched up there at the roof line like birds ourselves. Our cockatiels, even on a good dry day, are ill-tempered, very irritating pets. They do nothing. Janet bought them without consulting me. Right when our second kid went off to Middlebury, she explained, "Bill, they were on sale. Two for the price of one." The clerk said, "They're married." I go, "Well, in that case." Next, Jan made both of us seem even more conventional by naming the male for Bill Jr. and the girl for our brilliant linguist daughter, Jill. And I never once complained. After 45 years of marriage, there's too much to even start to say. We had loved living on the river. But seeing your town underwater is like studying the MRI, your whole damaged heart. It must be you. But it can't be you alive. Only thing showing above the waterline was the giant sycamores on Courthouse Square and church steeples, especially those braggart Baptist new chromium one. In the boat, we heard a sound like Niagara Falls, but somehow it was coming from underneath Ted Johnson's ranch house, and I don't understand. Tonight, I don't understand anything. When you lose your earthly goods overnight, you gain at least surprise and information. After that first gulp and uh-oh, there can come a startup champagne kind of giddiness. Registers almost as relief. Maybe only a man as old as I would think, no more hiring shiftless teenagers to overpay for grass mowing. Thank God. I had come to hate our enslaving acre and a half, and to think how much my farm-born dad had valued a green yard of no animal food value whatever. If Pop grew up fantasizing about town, my dreams had lately run toward silent farmhouses, one on my own, Presbyterian plain, zero maintenance. It would hold me, maybe seated cross-legged, alone on the plank porch, some Zen monk hayseed whose only crop would be invisible hanging gardens of meditation or whatever they do. Most of our antiques downstairs had come from Barton, Janet's mother's family, Edenton Plantation. Me being a tenant farmer's son, I'd inherited no object of importance whatever. For us Mabrys, everything had been makeshift as next month's rent. The importance of Barton's 1799 sideboards and wing chairs to Janet would prove far greater than even I had ever guessed. Sounds absurd to say my wife mistook such farm furniture for the missing plantation itself. Might seem silly to admit how the loss of one slave-made cypress break front would give my unsentimental darling a nervous breakdown, but that is really sort of what was just about to happen. We and 600 others spent that first night in the National Guard armory. If it's gem made for an unsightly B&B, at least the price was right. No friends could take us in, being flooded out as we. Now, many humans endure some one night when everything changes. Somehow us of Falls, North Carolina's 6,803 all drew September 15th. The richest people in town occupy Riverside's dozen square blocks surrounding us, ours. Falls' poorest folks live at sixes and sevens down near the closed cotton mill in Baby Africa. Its stretch of silt land has always been considered so worthless, freed slaves were given it for free. So into this overlighted army multi-purpose hangar, all us river rats crawled, finally together in one room for the first time ever. Whatever our class or race, we lugged the self-same items, I noticed. Family Bibles, deeds, love letters, photos of dead parents, of living children and grandkids. We held our damp pets shivering inside bath mats and pillowcases. Oh, I promised you this, we were none of us looking our tip-top best that night. Ex-North Carolina State linebacker, former Marine, Republican kingpin, Vern Haskell kept walking around in his pajamas, and he knew this, but he had forgotten wearing that avocado facial. And nobody pointed it out. Especially not his bullied wife, Tricia. In this gym crisscrossed by cots, echoing with yappy dogs and crying kids, you heard a jumpy madcap energy. You heard an intentional costume party's loudness. Everybody talked too much and all our info came through eavesdropping. But at least we were alive and recognized each other. Half the children underfoot kept acting out unsupervised. The rest in corners sat bent in thumb-sucking, fetal positions. We bunched here imagining how it had happened to be attacked from the rear like this, our placeholder waterway gushing suddenly with Mississippi ambitions. The why we would leave to helpless, half-drowned rabbis and rectors to explain next Sabbath. The how our government should have known. The government didn't represent us. The government should have warned us. We sat on our provided cots, Vietnam surplus. We shared common knowledge. The weather had lately changed. More snow. Hurricanes more frequent and far meaner. These days officials had to name so many storms a year they used up every English letter clear to X, and then they reverted to a second alphabet, the Greek one. That in itself sounded a bit un-American to me. The wife and I found among other Millen refugees, Lottie Clemens, 68, our retired longtime child care friend and cleaner. In her pink housecoat's pocket, I saw a Ziploc bag full of costume jewelry, years of Christmas gifts from our children and us. We seemed to be meeting on some train, speeding toward the same internment camp, now yelling for news of our place, whose counters she had wiped, whose floors she had vacuumed these 40 years. Lottie called over the noise, "The house! How the house?" Janet and I glanced at each other and then simplified our answer. We spared everyone's dignity by skipping details. About the house, we just shook our heads no. "Don't be telling me that now," she said. "Not the house. But Lottie, your boys. Oh, they safe. Youngest two run around here somewhere. Both that age where they all the time playing like they don't know me. Even while sitting there facing their own mama in the same boat." Then we kissed each other. I sort of cried all over Lottie, pillow breast and wiry arms. She fell against and between us. With our last formality and feeble manners shot, we re-understood our lives, our childbearing years and these longer hot flashing ones. Our whole life spans had been spent together in one shuttling station wagon, picking Lottie up in the morning and taking Lottie home at night. Picking Lottie up in the morning, and again, taking Lottie home at night. We had lived in the same few rooms. Rooms now 12 feet underwater. I vowed that night, if we ever got through this, I'd enlarge her pension. Lottie is a decent, funny woman with 4 sons, 12 grandkids, all somehow boys. And I did live to boost her retirement. I'm not bragging. My truly stepping up to actually finance in her old age, it was already overdue by about 4 years. The smaller the town, maybe the bigger its events feel, I don't know. But we were seated on our cots when my favorite tennis partner goes, "Guess you heard who they found naked up a tree." "No?" "Yeah. That tall pine at the corner of Elm and Spruce. You know that one. Diana Dupre. Wiggled nude out of her second story bathroom window, I guess, and her breaststroke got her just that far. Pine tree, too. And with her naked, you know that was scratchy." That couldn't have been comfortable. But uh-oh, nobody move. If I told you you were about to see Diana Dupre without makeup, hair wet, wearing just a tarp and men's barred boots, would you believe me? Miracles and wonders. Don't nobody look now. Please don't anybody turn now. We all turned. And then us fellas, tired and old as we felt tonight, we somehow helping each other rose as one, saluting at least our memory of first seeing Diana Dupre enter the country club dance wearing royal blue satin. Oh, eons back. Fall's greatest Caucasian beauty of our age now wrapped in a drop cloth. The whiskey-loving Diana Dupre dragged right this way, stood chuckling. She put one hand behind her head and the other on her hips, and she said, "Well, boys, this is what's left of the goods." And then, you know, dressed like a bag lady. No, dressed like a bag. She did a runway turn, witty, even in ruin, see? And do you know it's still registered as sexy? Maybe force of habit from all sides, I don't know. But we gladly made a place for her wedged in tight between us, and Diana fell asleep almost at once. Who knew she snored like a stevedore? And my dear Janet, who loathes all divas, was too in shock to even properly gloat. Now, encountering your neighbor in this overlit gym felt like a class reunion convened in some lesser circle of prison hell. Even the National Guard's hanging lamps had all been caged like convicts. You hugged your most casual friends, and why? Because they had also survived. Some of us had not. 2 pals we'd known for life had been electrocuted by a fallen power line. One beloved married pair drowned inside their own new sports car during a botched dash north that washed them straight off the Mill Road Dam. Now, greeting friends, finding them unhurt, you need not say a word. You knew that their good stuff must be like your heirlooms, so much soggy pulp. Jan and I slouched here with the crowd we usually saw only at the club near Month's End when you needed to eat a little of the food you'll pay for anyway. All that mattered was knowing others and being recognized by them. Broke, fresh out of shelter, we had so little else to recommend us. By now we were our aging phases. Credit lines, our former looks, others' memory of which beautiful house had been our own. But tonight also made for a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime bond. A revival meeting. It felt either like the end of something or a radical fresh start. Restless, I told Jan I'd wander like a nomad to see what I could see in this shelter. There was just one stretch of the armory's baseboard heat really working. I counted 20 wide-open family Bibles spread there on gym flooring, toasting some. Damp good books were attended by people waiting for those to slowly dry. As if stirring little campfires, seated folks would idly reach down and flip from the crisper old to a wetter New Testament. I heard certain guardians muttering to themselves. I slowly understood these sounds were not just shocked complaints, but stubborn, busted prayers. Bibles seemed more valuable for their tatted cross-shaped bookmarks, their brown Palm Sunday fronds. Some showed handwritten names and birth dates, marriages, then death dates. Books, black and white, attended by people, white and black, being dried face up, wide open as if meant to breathe. Hard to describe why that first evening should seem one of the most joyful of my life, or maybe memorable, which is joy at its most attention-getting. Had I, as a house-proud man with a retired insurance office income, been secretly waiting for maybe some higher octane of trouble? For some outside woe past my being built around a heart this bad. The second night would prove the killer. I don't even mention night number three. Those of us natives who'd not gone north to school, who'd stayed in Falls, we now had no place to stay. Jan's first impulse was borrowing a cell phone, calling our far-flung kids to reassure. You mean you didn't even know? Do you mean it's not on the national news yet? Well, thanks, we're okay, except Billy left his heart meds and the river's got him and people are feeding him aspirin like M&Ms over here. The house is likely a dead loss, but your dad and I aren't. What? Oh, honey, I will. Your daddy says hello. Hello, wave. She waved. I just didn't want you to worry. And here you had no idea. The media, I swear to God. I've got to a point where I just hate New York City. I just hate New York City. Without even asking us, they turned out all the lights at 10 sharp. I got into my cot beside Janet's cot, and with the cockatiels still noisy in their cage between us, we two held hands. Insomniac, on a good day, I knew I would never sleep again. Must systematically go over what's just happened. Maybe there's still a way out. Maybe something I just hadn't thought of. Must plan better up ahead. Try and keep things drier. Third floor only, maybe. Start making certain calls come morning. Come morning, must start over. But with me being 66, tell me how. My first beginning, it began with me already in it. This tired, how might I become aware enough to really try a second time? Maybe this go round I could get more gumption earlier. Till tonight the word homeless meant just those unlucky, maybe lazy folks you see begging while smoking on the median. Well, but that was me now. That was us. I pictured Jan and me begging. We would not be good at it. A flood in Falls just seemed so unplanned. Well, of course, Billy, don't you know there is no plan? That's what people have done forever, making plans around there not being a friggin' plan. Floods are not unusual. Floods here are unusual. This was just our night for one. Earth is just the least mean part of outer space. Nothing in the universe is personal, son, except for what's mine and real, real personal. Hey, but cheer up, I told myself. After all, what have you really lost, son? Well, let's see here. My heart meds, with every drugstore in three counties underwater. Damn pump still ticking. Adrenaline might get me through tonight anyways. Our car is, of course, replaceable. Pretty much the house. Admit it, 44 years, little improvements. Yeah. The whole house. And my keys. All my keys. Next into this huge dark room, a new surprise swept, nearly big as the flood. Sleep came on and over me, pure tidal wave relief. It took me down, down, lower, deeper than the black bottom of that flood old Noah sailed. I slept like a child who's never ever yet had to pay for anything. I, Mr. Somonex user, out solid 8 straight hours, sat up, was somehow in this weird army building, surrounded by dogs, birds, strangers, children playing tag, the smell of buttered toast, my dear particular wife off yonder, Janet, up as ever earliest, stood talking to Diana Dupre, who was wearing Jan's own favorite powder blue sweater. Diana had come in here near naked, and though Jan had only brought 2 pieces of clothing, though she'd always hated Diana's show-off ways, looked like my wife had just given the best cashmere sweater to her old enemy. Well, that seemed a big change in how we were all going to be treating each other up ahead. And right that second, finally admitting I had lost everything, I guessed at least I had somewhat survived, which, face it, is not nothing. True, every single item I ever bought, it just got ruined and then washed to other towns. Okay, but maybe that's just what they call downsizing. It was right about then Janet noticed me finally yawning and sitting up, and she waves and right off sets about bringing me some of their probably awful coffee. But with her knowing, you know, exactly how I like it. And leaning forward on an army cot, wearing my very worst looking undershirt, with not one life-saving heart pill to start taking first thing right here in front of strangers and my own wife, with all this mess just starting, really. I found I knew, however briefly. Hey, Bill, you do still get to be around a while, you see that? Well, yes, sir. Will you look at here? Amen, at least to that. You know what? I am alive. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Are there questions about the crimes of the Bush administration or the frustrations of internet dating? Anything I can go into at length? Yes.
Connect the title Decoy with the story.
Yeah. I don't want to give away too much because I want you to read it. But the flood happens, and the town doctor, who's the sort of Henry Fonda of everybody's dreams, you know, the Yale graduate who came home to the little town and takes care of everybody and has magical healing powers. determines to retire at 70 and becomes a decoy carver, a world-famous decoy carver, and lives on the river. He's living right next door to Bill, the narrator of this passage. And the river takes the decoys that he's been carving as artworks into the maelstrom. And that becomes a kind of emblem of a certain kind of way of living or a certain kind of doubleness. I don't want to explain my own work beyond that, but
Yeah.
And it's touching. My publisher, Norton, as this came out as one of three novellas in Local Souls last October. And the reviews singled this one out to such an extent that they determined to publish it as a separate book. So it's just come out yesterday, and it's now in the world.
How many pages is that?
It's about 200 pages.
The single story?
Yeah. It's I called it a novella because I was going to wedge it into this book. I think I probably could have. I always look back on my novellas and think that I could have published them separately. What they call a novel now is not. I call Middlemarch a novel. I call the Tin Drum a novel. I call the Magic Mountain a novel. And I have size anxiety when I whip out 35,000 words and call it a novel, you know. Put it back where it came from, and maybe you'll grow a little bit. I don't know.
Thank God your publisher protected you.
That's right, exactly. Are there other questions? Yes, please.
Have you ever experienced anything like that flood in your
own life? My hometown, Rocky Mount, North Carolina, lost a quarter of its real estate to a flood in 1999, the Hurricane Floyd flood. And I was not in the town. I was in North Carolina, and my brother, who lives in town, and is one of the rarest people in my family, a person of few words, you know. And, you know, if you have a person of few words in a talkative family, you actually listen when they call you up. And so I picked up the phone, and my brother said, "Come now." I said, "What?" He said, "Come. Don't go to any cocktail parties." He thinks that all I do is go to cocktail parties. Only your brothers think that, you know, you and your fancy friends. And he said, "Just come." I said, "I have a dental surgery." He said, "Cancel it." So I listened to him. I got in my car. It's about an hour and a half down there. And I drove to within 10 miles of the town, and there was a sea. Everything was underwater. That's right. And so I stood on a bridge over a former highway and thought, what do I do now? I can't wade. I can't swim that far. And a motorboat circled by, and somebody from the motorboat said, "Is that Alan Gerganus?" I said, "Well, yes, it is." He said, "It's Ronnie Pitt. I think you were the best damn vice president Rocky Mount Senior High School ever had. Get in this fucking boat. I'm going to show you some shit you won't believe." So I got in the boat, and it was Venice, you know, in Rocky Mount. I mean, the streets were clear. You only knew where the streets were because of the treetops and the steeples. And the house where I felt up my first girl, the house where I felt up my first boy, the house where I smoked my first marijuana cigarette, first tobacco cigarette, all underwater. There should be plaques on each of those. It was, and what I found fascinating, and what I put in Decoy, is how people respond to emergencies. The people that would seem to be the most prepared for disaster, by training and temperament and physical strength, are often the people who fall completely apart, and the rickety ones. Diana Dupre, who looks like an hysteric and so forth and so on, just swims until she finds somebody to rescue her. So it was fascinating that the person in town that I thought was the strongest person, who had a collection of Japanese miniatures that were lost instantly to the river, never recovered her sanity. She was a wealthy woman who had all the advantages. She could have replaced her collection, But the idea that she'd been saving these things since she was 20 and they would no longer be seen was just too much for her to bear, even though she had healthy children and a husband who loved her. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and tragic. So I went down to the town repeatedly to try to do some helpful things. And the amount of work was involved is just essentially emptying the shells of houses that were going to be bulldozed anyway, but you'd go through this soggy mess. And I asked two friends who lived there permanently, an Episcopal priest and a woman who was a nurse, to line up people who'd been through extraordinary experiences and to talk to me. And I recorded them. I never listened to the recordings. I mean, this is what happens when you're a dedicated fiction writer. You're really not interested in documenting a verbatim experience. You're interested in getting the essence of the event and trying to come to your own conclusions and trying to simplify and create a kind of perfume out of a field of flowers or an essence in black ink out of a disaster of this kind of magnitude. So it was fascinating, and I knew instantly that my brother had been right in summoning me. And I'm very grateful to him. So we try to use our disasters. That's what we do. Try to make some light out of darkness, you know. Yes?
Two questions. One comment. I love the line where the wife calls the kids to tell them she's okay, and they don't even know about it. That just said volumes.
Exactly. Well, as the world goes, this was a small disaster. I think the number of disasters we read about every day has become almost overwhelming. I'm the eldest of four sons, and I think those of us in the room who are eldest children know what a burden that is. It's one you never get over. You feel when you read the front page of the New York Times that it's your fault, and that you should have not been answering to Mama and Papa, or there really wouldn't be a mess in Bosnia. There really wouldn't be the beheadings and burnings and all the things that we've learned to live with. But, yes, I'm sorry, you were going to ask.
Were you reading from your manuscript rather than from the book?
I've made a manuscript, yeah. And when you read the novella, you'll discover that I've made some improvements in my manuscript. Rewriting is never done, brothers and sisters. No, it's never good enough. I don't care what the New York Times says. There's something wrong with this.
And I fix it.
Yeah, I will. I will. I'll send you the pages. The whole exchange between Diana Dupre and Janet, the wife, and the giving the sweater is something I added in this that's not in the book. But I think it's a beautiful event because there's this, suddenly everything has changed. If you only have two pieces of clothing, you give one to the naked person that you know. And it does seem a kind of signal for what the possibilities that are ahead. But I think rewriting is what we do. Somebody said, I rewrite to be reread. And there's a relationship between the number of times that you're willing to rewrite and perfect, and the number of readers who will put up with you and who trust you and know that you can move your hand over the ivory and there's no burr, there's no snag, that you've read it aloud a million times. And this is the two great pieces of advice that I can give to every writer in the room, which you all know already since you've heard it since third grade, is that verbs are God. Verbs are everything. If there's one part of speech left in the universe, it's a verb, and that's God. And the other thing is to read the work aloud so often that it's almost memorized. There's a kind of logic in conversation which is often superior to the logic of rhetoric and essay writing, especially the kind of 5-point essay writing that's taught in our public schools now, that are required on tests, which are killing us. There's a kind of illogic and movement and conversation. If you have a meeting with an old friend, you know that the topics jump from one to the other, and it makes perfect sense. The more you know a person, the less you have to say, I'm changing the subject now. This may seem a radical leap, but I'll tell you what, the deep associations, you just jump, jump, jump. And I think fiction is capable of that if it's prepared for orally and mentally. And the most interesting fiction for me is the fiction that's not A, B, G, but A, 39, K, Z. And to the extent that you can let the reader follow your logic, which is illogic, to that extent do you have a chance of saying something radical about the way emotion works, which is completely chaotic and surprising. People, you know, giggle at funerals and weep at weddings. You explain it to me. I don't know. But that's what we do as fiction writers, is we're you know, PhDs in emotion. That's what I really care about. And the work that doesn't excite me emotionally is not interesting to me, because it's dead. It's just cerebral. Our responsibility is much bigger than that. I just reread Middlemarch for probably the 40th time. And if you want to look for the great novel of the year, turn to George Eliot. It's unbelievable. It's so exciting. It's so thrilling. It's like a christening, an anointing. You just think, remember why you wanted to write in the first place. Thank you all so much for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. We have a special over here.